Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling one of the most foundational and frankly one of the most historically uncomfortable topics in the source material you've provided. We're talking about the introduction of polygamy or plural marriage in early Mormonism.
Yeah, and it's essential that we, approach this without any varnish. If the goal is to really understand this pivotal moment, we have to look directly at the inconsistencies. We have to look at the shifting timelines, the internal contradictions that just surround the whole practice.
It's historical reality, not just the faith-promoting narrative you might hear later.
Exactly.
And our mission here is pretty clear. We need to provide a precise timeline, really zero in on those contradictions, especially around first relationships, the public denials, and then sort of analyze the theological implications.
And this isn't just an academic exercise. I mean, we have to stress this. This history is still relevant because Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, it's still canonized. It's still in the book.
Which gives the implications of all this an eternal weight for all members today.
Absolutely. So we have to start at the theological beginning. And that starting line is found in the earliest scripture dictated by Joseph Smith. Before everything else, we have the Book of Mormon.
Okay, let's unpack that. If we turn to the Book of Mormon, what was the established theological position on a man having multiple wives?
The stance was, well, it was condemnation. And it was utterly explicit. If you look at the second chapter of the book of Jacob, it addresses this head on.
And it talks about David and Solomon, right?
It does. It says, "Their many wives and concubines were abominable before me, saith the Lord." It even goes so far as to call the practice whoredoms.
Wow. That's incredibly harsh language for scripture. It's not just discouraged, it's an abomination.
Exactly. God commands in that scripture that men shall have but one wife and concubines, he shall have none. This establishes the clear public theological boundary. Any deviation was sin.
But there was a loophole, wasn't there? A single, very narrow escape clause written into that condemnation.
There was, yeah. The text immediately reserves one possibility, and it is highly specific. It reads, "For if I will, saith the Lord hosts, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. Otherwise they shall hearken unto those things."
So the rule is monogamy. The exception is a direct divine command, and the only reason for that exception is to raise up righteous posterity. That's a critical starting point because the timeline, well, it immediately gets messy from here.
It does. The church narrative, the one that developed later, it really needed to backdate the introduction of polygamy to have it start well before the most scandalous events of the mid-1830s.
They needed to predate the Fanny Alger scandal.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And the event they often anchor this earliest practice to is a mission that was sent to the Native Americans, the Lamanites, as they were called, in 1831.
Okay, so what were the actual instructions for that mission? What did the earliest documented discussion of plurality actually sound like?
Well, it sounds nothing like the later doctrine of celestial sealing. W.W. Phelps, who is a pretty reliable early source, he claimed Joseph Smith told the missionaries that it was God's will they should take unto you wives of the Lamanites.
And what was the reason given?
So that their posterity might become white and delightsome.
So that's a direct link back to the Book of Mormon's own racial theories about the Lamanites and Nephites. It has nothing to do with eternal families.
Nothing at all. And we have confirmation of this from an antagonistic source, which, often lends more credibility. Ezra Booth, who had left the church, he wrote in 1831 that a revelation made it pleasing to the Lord to form these alliances with the natives, basically to gain a residence in the Indian territory.
So the earliest justification was, it was entirely disconnected from eternal exaltation or sealing keys. It was a practical, racially motivated idea of assimilation.
Precisely. A mortal, immediate command. And here is where the internal inconsistency gets truly profound. While this idea was allegedly circulating in 1831, Joseph Smith was dictating other scripture that reinforced the Book of Mormon's condemnation.
In the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yes.
Yeah.
D&C 42, verse 22, dictated in 1831, it commanded the saints, "Thou shalt love thy wife with all thy heart and shall cleave unto her and none else."
And there is another one too, right?
Yep. D&C 49, verse 16, it just says, "It is lawful that he should have one wife." And what's more, when Joseph later edited the Doctrine and Covenants in 1835, he had the perfect chance to insert a loophole. To clarify the one-wife rule, he didn't. He let the monogamy passages stand unchallenged.
So we've got a foundation of explicit condemnation, and then at the very time the plural practice allegedly began, we have active, contradictory scripture being canonized. The timeline is already full of holes.
Which brings us directly to the first known practical application, or maybe more accurately, the first known scandal.
The Fanny Alger affair.
Exactly. This happened around 1833 to 1836 in Kirtland.
Can you just set the scene for us? Who was she?
Fanny Alger was young, likely between 16 and 19. She was living as a maid in the Smith household. Joseph was in his late 20s. And the source material notes that the church now calls this Joseph's first plural marriage.
That word marriage is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, because if there's no divine revelation authorizing it and no official records, it's very hard to distinguish from, well, an affair.
That's the tension. And the accounts of this supposed marriage are highly suspect. The most cited one comes from a third-hand account from Mosiah Hancock, recorded way later in 1869.
Decades after the fact, what did that account claim?
It's pretty disturbing. It detailed Joseph allegedly brokering a deal. Hancock claimed Joseph said something like, "Brother Levi, I want to make a bargain with you. If you will get Fanny Alger for a wife or me for a wife, you may have Clarissa Reed."
That's chilling. I mean, the late date makes it dubious anyway, but the content itself suggests women are being used as bargaining chips.
And that view is, sadly, very consistent with the coercive theology that we see emerge later in D&C 132. But it's the immediate fallout that really tells the story.
Emma Smith's reaction.
Yes. Joseph's wife, Emma, discovered the relationship, and she immediately threw her out of the house in the night.
And there's an even more compelling piece of evidence that this was not seen as an authorized practice, and it involves Joseph's second-in-command.
Oliver Cowdery, his co-president. When he found out, he wrote a scathing letter calling the whole thing a dirty, nasty, filthy affair. This accusation was a major factor in his excommunication.
Let's just pause on that. I mean, if polygamy had really been revealed by God back in 1831, why would Joseph's number two, the second most powerful man in the church, not only be unaware of it, but react with such disgust?
It's a powerful question, isn't it? It strongly suggests that in 1835, Oliver Cowdery knew of no divine revelation authorizing polygamy. If he had, he wouldn't have called a commanded marriage an affair.
Right. And the public scandal in Kirtland must have gotten so intense that it forced the church to issue an official written denial.
Absolutely. The need to counteract the rumors led them to publish an article in 1835, which later got added to the Doctrine and Covenants, and it stated very clearly, "We believe that one man should have one wife and one woman, but one husband."
An unambiguous public statement to manage the scandal.
Mm-hmm. And then we're still in Kirtland. It's 1836, and Joseph claims to have received what we call the Kirtland Keys, D&C 110. This is where Elijah allegedly restored crucial priesthood keys.
But this story gets retrofitted later to cover polygamy, doesn't it?
It does. When you actually read the text of D&C 110 itself, there is no mention of eternal marriage or sealing or polygamy. None. It was only years later that the church reinterpreted this vision to be the specific restoration of the sealing keys needed for celestial marriage.
Which means whatever the Fanny Alger relationship actually was, it happened before the restoration of the keys the church now says are required to perform any legitimate eternal sealing.
It's another layer of theological complication. And as they move to Nauvoo, and Joseph begins to ramp up plural marriages around 1841, secrecy becomes everything. And that required a dangerous new theological framework to enforce silence.
This is where we get the no accuser teaching.
Yes, it's disturbing because it creates a kind of internal spiritual blackmail. In 1841, Joseph was recorded telling the inner circle not to expose the leaders. He taught, "If you do not accuse each other, God will not accuse you. If you have no accuser, you will enter heaven."
That is a direct threat wrapped up in a spiritual promise. Don't talk and you'll be saved.
He cemented the deal by saying, "If you will throw a cloak of charity over my sins, I will over yours." He created this pact of non-accountability, basically neutralizing anyone who might speak out by threatening to expose their own sins in return.
So that teaching was a critical tool that let the more complicated practices of Nauvoo flourish in secret. And the most complicated of all was, without a doubt, polyandry.
Polyandry. It means marrying a woman who is already married to another man. And what's astonishing is just how common this was for Joseph Smith.
How common?
He was sealed to as many as 11 already married women. The sources are pretty clear that a striking number 9 of his first 12 plural marriages were polyandrous.
The church today sometimes tries to justify this by saying it was, you know, a benign spiritual thing to link families together for eternity.
that justification just falls apart when you scrutinize it. Many of these women were married to faithful, active members of the church. One was even married to an apostle.
Right. And if the goal was just to link the family to the prophet, there was already a way to do that.
There was. It was called the law of adoption. Joseph could have just sealed the husbands to him to link the families. The fact that he sealed himself to the wives instead suggests the goal was something else entirely.
And it had devastating eternal implications.
It did. If Joseph's sealings were real, the doctrine would mean that any children born to the woman and her first faithful husband would actually be sealed to Joseph Smith for eternity. It would take the children away from their biological father in the afterlife.
And polyandry also creates a massive contradiction with the later written revelation with D&C 132 itself.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
When we finally get to D&C 132, it includes language that says a woman must be a virgin to qualify for celestial marriage. Polyandry completely defies that. The whole thing is just theologically chaotic.
So all this brings us to the moment the doctrine was finally written down in July of 1843, the dictation of D&C 132.
Right. This happened when Emma was struggling immensely with the practice, and Joseph's brother Hiram thought that if they just had it written down as a formal revelation, he could finally persuade her.
And the dictation itself is, I mean, it's one of the most significant and overlooked moments in Joseph Smith's entire career. Hiram asks him to use the Urim and Thummim, the seer stone, to dictate it.
To link it back to the process for the Book of Mormon.
And Joseph's response?
He refused. He told Hiram he did not need to, for he knew the revelation perfectly from beginning to end.
Okay, here's where the historical evidence gives you a huge insight. How long is this document that he claimed to know perfectly?
D&C 132 is over 3,200 words long.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, that's like an entire very productive day's worth of Book of Mormon dictation. He produced this lengthy, dense, complex scripture, speaking in the voice of God, completely off the cuff.
And this is so important because for his whole career, the argument was that Joseph needed the seer stone. He needed external aids because he wasn't educated enough to produce sophisticated texts like the Book of Mormon on his own.
Yet here he is. He demonstrates in one sitting this profound, effortless ability to generate 3,200 words of complex religious scripture in God's voice, including new counsel designed to deal with his current struggles with his wife, Emma.
The implication just cuts directly against the argument that he lacked the capacity to author the Book of Mormon himself. He clearly had an immense capacity for this kind of spontaneous creation.
It certainly shows that. And understanding the mechanism of its creation is crucial for understanding the claims surrounding all his other works.
We've covered a massive amount of ground. We've established these deep inconsistencies, starting with the Book of Mormon's flat-out condemnation, then the conflicting revelations of 1831, the ambiguity of Fanny Alger.
And we noted how that secrecy led to the dangerous no-accuser teaching and the theological chaos of polyandry, which defied the logic of both the law of adoption and the very text that would eventually govern the whole practice.
And all these timeline issues were, it seems, retrofitted decades later to create a cleaner, more defensible narrative. But the contemporary record tells a very different story.
And this leads us to the final and, I think, most provocative thought for you to consider. Since we've established that Joseph Smith could, apparently, effortlessly dictate 3,200 words of complex scripture in the voice of God without any external aids,
then the next logical step is to analyze the actual content of those 3,200 words. The fact he could dictate it so easily suggests a high level of authorial intent. So now we have to ask, what does the specific language and what do the coercive patterns inside D&C 132 actually say about his intent toward his followers and specifically toward women?
That analysis will be vital.
Until then, be well and keep digging.